This is episode number 750 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about New York Comic Con, Mockingbird, and the new Logan trailer. Our comics this week will be Puppet Master, Halloween 1989, Big Trouble in Little China, Escape from New York number 1, Star Wars Darth Vader number 25, Revolution number 1, and Kiss number 1. Our Out of the Long Box this week will be Morning Glories number 1.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
Seconds to comply.
Good, clean, wholesome fun.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here as always with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
Doing well, but very concerned about this weather. It is confusing. It's like 100 degrees outside and it's October.
I'm going to tell you right now, I don't care for it.
Nope, not at all. I am
ready for fall.
Yep.
There are leaves on the ground.
Yep.
That are crunchy when I step on them. And the air should be crisp. And the temperature should be at most in the 50s right now.
Yeah, it should be. It should be a little cooler out. It should be a lot less sunny out. Uh-huh. It should be sort of a white scale.
Instead we have hot and humid.
Ugh, garbage.
The worst.
Yep. Sun, so overrated. Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling we won't be saying that for too much longer, but let's go already. It's October 20th.
Yep. For a lot of people, and including myself, fall is our favorite season, and right now you're taking away our favorite season.
You are, because I do not want to go from late summer into winter.
Yeah, because that's what will happen. Next week, we'll get 400 feet of snow.
Next week, we'll be shoveling.
Yep.
All right, enough of the old man minute. last week, Matthew, first of all, congratulations on 750 episodes of Secret Identity.
750, congratulations.
I remember when we were doing our 75th episode, and I believe it was InvinciFan who sent in a Venture Brothers-themed congratulations on 75 episodes thingy.
I think I see that.
I still have it, actually. Yeah.
Absolutely. I love that.
So now I can just Photoshop a zero on the end of that, and we'll go from there.
That is a lot of friggin' episodes.
It's a lot of freaking episodes. You're absolutely right, Matthew. A lot of freaking episodes it is. So we're going to do what we always do, which is not make a big deal out of that and move right along into our news. Now, we talked last week about what was the attendance like at New York Comic Con. You felt like even – you didn't know what they were going to say.
Yep.
But you felt like it didn't feel as crowded as it has been in past years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm here to tell you, Matthew, as this might not come as a surprise to you, that New York Comic Con said there was a lot of people there this year.
There were a lot of people.
This is from Newsarama, by the way, which I believe is from obviously information that ReadPop sent them. It says, this year's New York Comic Con, which took place last weekend, set an all-time attendance record of over 180,000 based on the number of passes sold, according to Publishers Weekly. This tops the previous year's record of 167,000 tickets sold. Despite the large audience, polling from the pop culture analyst Rob Salkowitz suggests that only 6% of fans attending NYCC are there for comic books.
And I would agree with that.
Hold on to that thought for a second. Though ReadPop, the proprietors of NYCC, dispute these numbers based on their own internal polls, with Senior VP Lance Fensterman saying, if it's only 6%, a lot of people selling things there should be out of business. As for the future of NYCC, Fensterman is looking at Austin's South by Southwest Festival as an inspiration. Says there are ways in which we can mimic South by Southwest their model for our own geeky ways. I think that's really what we want to work towards, explained Fensterman. I really think we can create a festival all over the city. The offsite venues all worked, and there are more venues we can move into, and we can spread out, and we will. NYCC will return in 2017, October 5th through the 8th. So a couple of things there. Let's first talk about the 180,000. So according to them, the most ever, clearly now surpassing by a good amount, San Diego Comic-Con.
Yeah, and last year, I would agree, last year was a crazy amount of people just to try to maneuver in and out of. And
yeah.
I hate to say it, I look at attendance as if I can walk through the aisles, and if I can get to a bathroom. And if you remember last year, you would be going, all right, it's going to be an event. I've got to go to the bathroom. I'll be back in an hour.
Uh-huh.
That did not happen. You basically went to the bathroom, you waited in line for a few minutes, and then you came back. And water fountains, there weren't lines there. There weren't that usual group of people just kind of plopping down on the floor by the bathrooms,
sure,
by the Italian ice vendor. The escalators were never a problem. And if you remember two of those years, we would get down the escalator and just hit a wall of people.
I wonder if what you're seeing now, though, is the fact that for the second year in a row, more and more of what used to be in one venue has been spread out across multiple venues.
And that is a good point.
Yeah.
There were a lot of events. I know there was a Doctor Who event that was at Madison Square Garden.
There's Madison Square Garden, which the first year they did like a Walking Dead thing there.
Yep.
Now they had more events there. This year, the Hammerstein had a couple of events last year. Now it was pretty much programming all weekend long. So they're definitely moving into these other places, which are pulling people from the Javits at different points during the day, which for traffic purposes is not necessarily a bad thing.
Like, no.
I don't necessarily disagree with Fensterman's model of South by Southwest of like, hey, let's have this be an event around the whole city. You know, I think they call it NYCC Super Week or something like that. That's great. I mean, you have Midtown Comics, you have Jim Hanley's, you have these comic areas, you have Mocha, you have plenty of venues that you could be celebrating comic books and comic book related things across the city, as well as other things. So there's certainly room to do that. I, however, don't necessarily disagree with the notion that a very small percentage of people who come there are there for comics now.
Yes. And when you talk about that, we maybe have to kind of break that down is that 5% of the people that are there for comic books are the ones that are looking for the creators,
uh-huh,
as well as buying comics. I do agree with that. I think the number might be a little higher. But just because you wear a Batman costume doesn't mean you're there for comics.
No, it because you might like the movie universe.
You're just there celebrating Batman. And I think you get more people, I would say 70 to 80% on a guess, are there just to celebrate the medium and not necessarily there to purchase and discover new comics and connect with the creators that write some of the books that they like. I think that if you just said, tell you what, we are going to open up the Javits Center for $5. You can come in if you're in a costume and just walk around and see everybody and show off your costumes. I think the majority of the people that are there would do that. I really believe that. And that's not a knock. It's just this is the culture we live in with it. It is when comics all of a sudden with manga and anime brought in a younger audience, it changed the dynamic of the traditional comic shows. Then when the shows on TV started to become comic booky and very popular, it again changed the dynamics of the shows where you're going to a show and you can either go to a Flash panel or meet somebody from the Flash. You're going to go meet somebody from the Flash.
Right.
The comics, it's sad. It's like we used to talk about all the time where when we were kids, the Superman movie pushed and propelled the comic book and DC Comics, where the comic books are basically the advertisements for it. And I'm willing to bet that they make more, you know, DC probably does better and makes more of a hit with superheroes walking around Six Flags than they do the comic books.
Well, and I think that there, and obviously anybody can weigh in on the Facebook page. Anybody can send us in an email about, you know, their thoughts about this. My thought is that longtime comic book fans now are at a point where they're, and much like with San Diego, are starting to resent those shows, right? Mm-hmm. Because they are no longer about what they want to be. I think it was Billy Tucci posted the other day of like, hey, I love seeing these celebrity, you know, announcements of guests for all these upcoming cons. How about, you know, announcing some of the comic creators that are going to be at these cons? And so I think even the creators are feeling that. I think a lot of the longtime fans are feeling that. But my question is that New York Comic Con's fault? I don't think that it is.
No, because they're trying to make money. They're trying to push and make money.
They're going to cater to whatever the biggest fandoms are.
Yes.
Right? So I don't think that that's going to change anytime in the near future. I think what a bigger problem is why Marvel and DC, and to a lesser extent, the other publishers who have properties that are now on television and in the movies, why you are not seeing a stronger connection to the comic book creators.
Yeah.
So for example, you have Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. right now, and you have Ghost Rider, who's on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Robbie Reyes, the run that we talked about here, should you not, first of all, I don't think there is a Robbie Reyes comic right now with him in it, but don't you think that they should be, at the end of every episode, like, hey, you know, tonight's episode was based on a storyline from such and such, or, hey, you know, over on Supergirl, hey, do you want to know more about Mon-El? Go over to dccomics.com right now, and you'll see an essential reading list for all of the Mon-El storylines that have come out. Or, oh, you know, do you remember this iconic shot from tonight's episode and where it's Superman carrying Supergirl, like the Crisis on Infinite Earths, you know, or Infinite Crisis or whatever? Here, this is where that came from. Like, take 10 seconds or 20 seconds at the end of an episode, in the beginning of an episode, in the middle of an episode, to connect between what you're seeing on screen and these stories that all of these shows are based on, that all of these characters are based on, and the creators that created them. Like, take five. They do all the time on Walking Dead. They'll say, you know, stay tuned after tonight's episode and we'll talk to Greg Nicotero, who did the special effects. Dude, I love Greg Nicotero. Have always loved Greg Nicotero. Amazing special effects guy, and now directs the show and produces the show and all that kind of stuff. But let's talk about the comic book a little bit more. Like, I feel like these companies are doing nothing to link the comic books to the characters, to what people are seeing on the small and the big screen. And so when people come to New York Comic Con and they're dressed up as Harley Quinn from the Suicide Squad movie, or Deadshot from the Suicide Squad movie, or Arrow from the Green Arrow TV show, and they don't know anything about the comic, and they don't know anything about the creators, and they don't even know there is a comic related to that, that's not New York Comic Con's fault.
No.
That is DC Comics' fault.
Yep.
Because they are doing nothing with the marketing time that they have to promote the comic book side of things. And I think that tells you a lot about where the industry is at, just in terms of, like, what audience takes more preference. But they're leaving money on the table. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
But if you want people to care about comic books more, you have to make people aware that there are actually comic books.
And the interesting thing, like we were talking about with the Reed Pop part of it, is I will never fault Reed Pop for what they're doing, because you're a business. And I can think like a capitalist. If I have a business, I want to make as much money as I possibly can, and I want to continue and build a legacy that year after year is going to sustain itself. And I can completely, and I am in the boat with Billy Tucci. Hey, why don't you start pushing some of the comic creators that are there? The sad part is that they keep almost pricing those guys out of Artist Alley. And again, not Reed Pop's fault for wanting no comic book creators. They're just saying, look, we're going to give you, if you can pay for it, we're going to give you your spot, but you got to pay for it. And unfortunately, that's where it's going. And that's where we've seen, like, even with smaller shows, the medium sized ones, they're starting to kind of fizzle out, peter out, because they can't sustain all this stuff that's going on when the basis of it is comic books. That's really what it is. And all this other fill to bring somebody that's a guest, you know, to bring David Prowse, who played Darth Vader, into a show, that's going to be 90% of your budget, and you've got to make that up somewhere. So you're going to jack your price. You're going to add extra for the booth and the tables. That's where your resentment all starts, is because you're trying to pay that. And everybody that goes to see David Prowse is not going to go see you and I, Billy Tucci, Jamal, you know, all of our friends that are sitting there. They're not going to go see them. That's not why they're there. And it is a sad thing. I mean, I don't know anything about San Diego. I know it used to be a comic book show, and apparently it is more in line with the Hollywood side of New York Comic Con. But it seems like these shows are becoming Comic Con in name only.
Well, and the question is, how long will that remain the case?
Yeah.
How long until it's New York Pop Culture Con?
As long as people still, you know what I mean? When will Artist Alley?
Well, Artist Alley, it sounds like next year is getting moved to the basement. Or something like that. Like, I know it's not going to be in the hangar.
Yeah, because they're building onto the hangar. They're adding a couple extra levels, so they got to shut that part down. But now you're going to be putting the artists, and that's where the basement was, where the first show was. I remember when the first show was in the basement, and then second floor. Then next year was the main stuff, and the second year was
the area that is the press area now.
Yep.
Which is the sort of the staircase leads up, and you go back, and it's not even being utilized. It's just a press area now, or VIP area, or whatever. Used to be Artist Alley.
That used to be Artist Alley.
And you would go there, and all the artists were in the same area. And I mean, we sound like we're down on New York Comic Con. Again, I don't think it's a New York Comic Con problem. I think it's a pop culture problem.
It's a hobby problem.
That these properties that have blown up into something that's a multimedia giant are not connecting, even the video game stuff. Yep. Like you have the Arkham video games, which are renowned video games. Where in the game is it redirecting you back to the comics?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? When I buy a copy of that video game, shouldn't I open up my plastic case for that game and see a discount coupon for the first trade of this particular storyline of Batman? Shouldn't I see, you know, 10% off the DVD or something like that? Like, get people to understand that there is content that these things are pulling from, and help them find that content. And so I think if they could do a better job of that, if they care to do a better job of that, then more people who are celebrating what they're seeing on TV and in the movies would go looking for those comic creators back at Artist Alley.
Yeah, I think because of the last year where it was the Titanic was sinking, and then this year, oh my God, we went right by the iceberg and everything's awesome and everybody's happy. I don't think we're going to see any changes until another iceberg shows up. And that's business again right there. That's the state of the world right now.
Yeah.
Is, and you don't fix it unless it's broken. And you don't care if it's broken as long as you still got money coming in.
Yeah. I mean, for the creators, obviously, there are other shows to go to. And you might make the argument that you will make money more at those smaller shows more than you will make them at the big mm-hmm. shows, because there's less competition.
Yep.
You know, and maybe the entrance fee is a little bit cheaper to go into some of those other shows. So, but always, we'd love to hear what other people think about that. In other gaming news, Matthew, or convention news rather, our good buddy Mitch Halleck, who is the guy behind Terrificon at Mohegan Sun, is launching a gaming convention this year. In April 1st and 2nd, 2017, Connecticut GamerCon is a celebration of all types of games, video, tabletop, collectible card, board games, and even pinball. They're going to cover the entire spectrum from arcade classics and retro gaming to today's mega blockbusters, and it's going to be at Mohegan Sun. So I am very excited about this as a lifelong gamer.
Yes.
And I've been talking to Mitch a little bit about what that show is going to look like. It's fascinating to be talking to someone who is putting a show together, and we have had the good fortune to have many conversations like that over the years, except it's usually about comic book shows.
Yes.
And a lot of armchair quarterbacking or Monday morning quarterbacking with that kind of stuff. Putting a gaming show together, really interesting, because those shows have also blown up over the past few years. You have PAX East now in Boston, which sells out almost as quickly as New York Comic Con sells out, and is an absolute feeding frenzy to the point where it's now hard to get into that show.
Mm-hmm.
So there are room for some of these other shows to come along. And the question is, like, what is your target audience? What are you trying to bring to the table with this show? Because we're seeing that some of these shows now are struggling to try to be everything to everyone, and it's hurting them.
Yeah. And you know, what a great way to do something like celebrate the gaming. I mean, I don't know if he's going to be doing it in the same room. I'll be seeing Mitch this week. So I think I'm going to be doing a little interview about the gaming side of this, with the gaming show that he's doing. Being a non-gamer, what is the appeal? Why should I go to this? Because once it was announced, I mean, my wife was the one who said, Mitch is doing a gaming show in April. I'm like, yeah, I'll be there. You know, even though I'm not into it, if you put games up, I'll play them, but I'm not a diehard gamer. But the culture is much like comic books, and it's like music, and it's like all the things we love. If you're in it, you are into it. And I love being around your passion for gaming. I sat through, was it Mario Kart? Was that the game we were playing with
Parker? It was Mario Kart on the Wii U that we were playing a little tournament of with my son when we were at Kineticon this year.
Yep. And I got destroyed, but I love the enthusiasm that you two had and the bickering back and forth between you guys.
Here's something, and as we are recording this today on October 20th, here's something that I think is actually going to be a nice boost for Mitch's show. The Nintendo, it used to be called the NX, was the working title for it. There was a big thing about Nintendo's going to announce their new console. It's supposed to be coming in March of 2017. Well, we heard nothing for a long time. This morning, Nintendo announced the Nintendo Switch, and that is going to be their new console, and is a hybrid console that has a set of removable controllers, but it's like a tablet. And you will dock it in a dock that lets you play on your television, and you will be able to undock it and take it with you, almost like the DS, and have it be portable. That is coming out
a
few weeks before Mitch's show. So if he could somehow get some of those new Nintendo Switch units at this Connecticut GamerCon, that would be a reason for people to come to that show and check that out to get their hands on this brand new hardware from Nintendo. So that could be serendipitous timing for yes. Mitch's show there, but really exciting stuff. And if you care about games and you want to hear more about that stuff, Nick Merritt and I just put up a special episode of the Co-op Critics podcast today about the announcement of the Nintendo Switch, and it is at co-opcritics.com, co-opcritics.com. You can go and listen to that. So I'm excited about that convention coming around. We don't have a ton of gaming conventions here in New England outside of PAX East, so that is good. And it'll be interesting to see how that first year goes. So one more piece of news before we wrap up the news, Matthew. Actually, a couple more pieces. Number one, sad news this week, Mockingbird canceled with issue number 8.
Did not realize that.
Mockingbird was a book that I talked about a couple times on this show, I believe. And this week, issue number 8 came out, and it is canceled. This is coming from The Beat. Chelsea Kane and Kate Nimzik's Mockingbird has been one of the more critically beloved titles to come out of Marvel's 2015 all-new, all-different relaunch. Unfortunately, like many recently critically lauded titles such as Omega Men and Prez before it, Mockingbird ends with today's release of issue number 8. Talking on Twitter, Kane announced the news with an impassioned plea. Please buy Mockingbird number 8 this Wednesday. Send a message to Marvel that there's room in comics for superhero stories about grown-up women. So this was from the writer of that Mockingbird series. So clearly not thrilled that the book is getting canceled. And that's unfortunate because I thought that book was interesting. And that's a character who I think was ready for her own series. She's shown up a lot in Amazing Spider-Man working with Peter Parker. But that series was interesting and funny and action-packed. And so that's a bummer that that's getting canceled.
And I picked up the last issue of Howard the Duck today or yesterday.
But that was that planned?
That was sort of planned.
I think so.
It was planned as much as you can plan a cancellation. But it is sad. It's sad to see some of these books that we have been loving that are off the beaten path starting to get kicked into the river.
Well, and Marvel's doing that whole next round of releases now because Marvel now just, we talked about Champions in the last episode or the episode before that, and there's some new titles coming from them. So they're sort of in a state of wrapping up some of the 2015 series and kicking off some of these new series that are launching through Marvel now. So it'll be interesting to see which ones stick and which ones sort of go by the wayside.
Now, is it Marvel Now or is it Marvel Now? Right now.
It's like Marvel Right Now.
Okay, because I'm getting confused with which one is which.
I'm pretty sure it's got a big exclamation point next to it. So that is your news, and that brings us over to comics. But before we talk about comics, we have to talk about your facial hair, Matthew.
Before we talk about facial hair, didn't you want to talk about a trailer?
Oh, well, let's, you know what? Let's put them both together. Speaking of great facial hair.
Yes.
We watched the new trailer for Logan today, and that is the upcoming last Wolverine movie starring Hugh Jackman. We had heard rumors that it could be sort of an old man Logan type of thing, and that is absolutely what this is. You got Johnny Cash singing Nine Inch Nails Hurt,
yes,
I believe, and you have a very old Professor X and an old Wolverine and a very young X-23 in this movie, and it seems like it almost had kind of a post-apocalyptic sort of a vibe to it.
There's water towers all knocked down all over the place, and you definitely get that.
Maybe it's just that he's living in the middle of nowhere. I don't know.
It almost feels like that. It definitely feels like it's not a good time in the world. But the thing that is completely off-putting in a good way is you've got the very monotone Johnny Cash, who I grew up listening to because my dad was a huge country and Western fan and a folkie. So I grew up listening to that stuff where I always knew what my dad's moods were with whatever music he listened to.
Uh-huh.
If he was in a bad mood or sad mood or melancholy, it would be, "Hello, I'm Johnny Cash." And it would be very monotone when he sang. And to me, that is so off-putting because it's an uncomfortable feeling when I hear that music. And the trailer, it fits it perfectly where I was completely sucked in the first 5 seconds. And then you see this little girl show up. And what I like about it, she looks like a little girl, like an 8 or 9 year old, not a 17, 18 year old. She looks like a little kid, which I love that fact because now we may get a character to grow into, but they're setting the stage for Hugh Jackman gone, new Wolverine coming in.
Yes. I think that, so I agree with you. The trailer was very interesting and not, I think, what we expected in terms of tone. I suspect we'll see another trailer in a month or two that is much more action-packed. But this first one was there to sort of establish that this is a different time in yeah. Logan's life. And he is at a point where it almost looks like he's sort of ready to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And here along comes this little girl who needs him. And if it is X-23, which they never said her name, I don't think we saw her brandish any claws
nope.
in the trailer. But we did see one scene where she sort of pounces on someone. So I think we can safely assume at this point that we're talking about X-23. But that whole mentoring and maybe even sort of father figure relationship there, I think could be interesting, especially because they can also pull from the Cable series from a few years ago. Remember the one that Ariel Olivetti?
Yeah, when he was bouncing.
Where he was bouncing through time trying to protect Hope.
Yes.
From because she was the savior of sort of the mutant race and stuff like that. Like that, I see influences. I also see influences of the video game The Last of Us and the story The Road. I see a lot of that stuff in this particular trailer as well. So we'll see if that stuff pans out. But Wolverine in this trailer, Matthew, has a wonderful, wonderful beard.
He does. He looks good.
And I'm wondering what sort of product he uses in order to keep that beard in such great condition.
I'm wondering if he's using VikingOilsLLC.com. If you want to forget the weather we're having right now in New England, folks, because the cold is coming. So if you want to make sure that you are keeping that hair underneath your beard lush, keeping that skin fresh, keeping it exciting and vibrant and non-itchy, you need to pick up some Viking Oils, LLC.com. Everything is there. I'm still using the beard balm, keeping things. And I will say right now, this is the longest I have not shaved.
Well, and your buddy who runs the company.
Yes.
May want to get on creating some sort of a Logan line.
Yes.
Before that movie comes out, you know?
When you think of Logan, what do you think of for a scent? I think leather. Like a leathery.
I think wet dog. But something you don't want, that, not that, that's not something
will,
you want.
I was thinking right. That
you
will
want,
sell.
You want something that will sell. So sure, sort of a leathery.
Yeah.
You know, with maybe a tinge of copper.
Yeah.
Know, just a tinge of some sort of metallic sort of a tinge to it.
He'd make a fortune.
Yeah.
We'll talk to him
and
about
maybe
that.
Sunflowers. You know,
we'll
with Wolverine.
Talk to that.
It's very sort of.
But definitely check him out. You can like him on Facebook as well.
So there you go. That's your embedded ad for this episode. And the last thing we saw was, of course, the new Star Wars trailer.
Oh, I am getting more fired up about it, and to think it's only 2 months away.
Yeah.
I'm loving the fact that every Christmas we're gonna get a new trailer. We're seeing a lot more now of it, and we're seeing the fact that we are literally, as they're putting the Death Star in orbit, kind of thing. So we're getting maybe 2 or 3 months before A New Hope starts, which is, I am just excited about this one. And the thing, like, you know, when we used to talk about Friday the 13th and that scene when Freddy, or Nightmare on Elm Street, when Freddy was walking down the hall or the alley and his arms were outstretched.
Super long arms, yep.
And things like that don't look right, but keep you a little off balance.
Uh-huh.
And we talked about the trailer for Wolverine. Seeing stormtroopers coming off the beach in the water.
Yeah.
Is really weird to see. And it is creepy when you see walkers like trampling palm trees. There's something kind of weird about that, but I am so excited.
Yeah. The contrast of like the broad daylight.
Yes.
And the very sort of sunny, almost tropical feel to, and then the carnage that's happening
yeah.
around it.
And I'm very excited about this one. I am, I'll be there again opening day like I was for Force Awakens.
Yep.
And I'm more excited about this one than I was The Force Awakens.
And that is a good segue into the comic that you're going to talk about today, because this particular character that you're going to speak about does make an appearance in that film.
And it's funny when you see the trailer, the new trailer, where you're like, you are going to see Darth Vader. You see him for like 3 seconds come walking up, and you're like, and then it's all over.
Yep.
So if you want more Darth Vader, you can head to your local comic shop and pick up Star Wars Darth Vader number 25, but be warned, last issue. And I will say, I'm glad it is. And the reason being is this is a 25 issues have gone.
That's a good run, dude.
I would say the first 10 or 12 were solid. Then it started to lose it a little bit. They were introducing characters that I wasn't necessarily liking. But this issue is one of these ones where it just puts the nail on the coffin for the series.
Bookends it.
And what had happened is, starting off, is that this is like the week after the Death Star blew up. And Darth Vader shows back up. It's been a rough week. Meets with the Emperor, gives him his progress report. And the Emperor's like, yeah, you're not what I thought you would be. I'm a little disappointed. And if you remember the officer that he choked in Star Wars, I think that's...
There's so many, Matthew.
The one in the first one when he... actually, the guy who was... when he choked him in the first movie, the, you know, your sorcerous ways haven't found us.
Right, right.
The, you know, that guy and
Mr. Crap Talker.
Lack of faith that's disturbing. There was a guy sitting next to him that had sort of a bowl haircut, and he was the one that created the Death Star. This Death Star is operational. I suggest we use it and blah, blah, blah. He now works for that guy. So that guy is now in charge of Darth Vader.
Uh-huh.
And he has been running him all over the place, running him ragged. And one of the stories that was finishing up is that there is a guy that has almost been Darth Vader's foil for the entire series who has been bouncing from body to body and saying, you know what? I don't need the Force to do this. Look how much I can live. I can live forever. They keep battling. He was the prince of a planet that the Empire needed for raw materials. And once there was a war there, this guy became obsolete and Darth Vader didn't need him anymore and didn't have to play the game. So Darth Vader's been going after him. And interesting that as they were on a ship, he's sitting there telling Darth Vader, you know, you may be able, you can kill this body, but you are not going to kill me. And Darth Vader happens to look down and notice that the floor that they're standing on is like this living brain. And it's this brain that keeps this guy Silo going. So Darth Vader realizes that if he destroys that brain, he will destroy everything. So as they are, Darth Vader puts them on a course towards a sun. And as they're heading towards the sun, the ship goes in, it blows up, Silo is dead. That's the end of that story. Now he's on the Executor, which is the large Star Destroyer that you first see in The Empire Strikes Back. And this is the Star Destroyer that is Darth Vader's personal, but up until this point, it is not. So he goes and sees the Emperor, and he's like, you know, I'm waiting for your full report. And he says, but first of all, I got somebody you want to see. And he brings out this young girl who I forgot her name, Dr. Aphra. Now, Dr. Aphra is somebody that works with droids, is very good with droids, started working with Darth Vader to help him out on some things. And what was going on for a little bit was Darth Vader was going kind of behind the Emperor's back. He was doing everything he could to give himself a good name, get himself back in good graces. And he explains, and the Emperor explains to him, going, you know, one of the things about this young girl that I find fascinating, Vader, is that you and her stole Imperial funds. You stole Imperial supplies, ordinances, everything to try to do some things. And Darth Vader was about to try to explain what was going on. And the girl goes, oh boy, you're in trouble right now. And the Emperor goes, I'm really impressed with that. And the Emperor goes, you know, it takes a lot to go after the guy who's in charge, especially one that's not happy with you, and especially one that created you. So I really applaud you for trying to do something to not only write your name, but to make up for everything that you have done and all the things that are going on. So the Emperor is very happy with this, with Darth Vader again. And he says, so you know what? I want you to take care of Dr. Aphra as you please. And by the way, head over to head to the bridge of this ship. So as they start walking, Darth Vader and this girl are talking, and the girl's like, well, you know, I did prove my loyalty to you, right? You do know that. And he's like, oh yeah, yep. And, you know, I appreciate that, but now it's time for you to go. And he opens up the airlocks, throws her in there, closes the door, and sucks her out the airlock. No longer to be seen, or maybe. So then Darth Vader ends up on the bridge of the ship. And Admiral Ozzel, who is the guy in command at The Empire Strikes Back. Oh, Lord Vader, we've brought the fleet out of hyperspace.
I like how you add a line of dialogue to each character as you introduce them, just for everybody else. Just to bring them right back.
And then Darth Vader chokes him. I find you you are as clumsy as you are stupid, and he chokes him right there. So you're seeing Admiral Ozzel as he's still just a captain. And he goes up to the guy that was on the Death Star that was, you know, kind of firing up a little bit. And the Emperor tells Darth Vader, he goes, you know what? This is now your ship. Congratulations. Everybody is under your command, so you need to just do what you need to do. So he goes up to that officer, and I'll show you, Brian, the look on his face. It's like a puppy dog, because he's been riding Darth Vader like crazy, and now the leash has been removed. So he's saying, Lord Vader, you know, this has been a difficult time.
Yeah.
We've had our differences.
Tough times. We've had some challenges.
We lost the Death Star. All these things went on, but you have to understand that I was trying to do what was right by the Empire and for the Emperor, and this is what he wanted. And you've got Ozzel just kind of staring and looking, and then he picks him up, chokes him, slams him up against the wall, and he's dead. And then he says, Admiral Ozzel, when will the executor be ready? The executor be ready? And he's like, oh, you know what? It's probably be about a month. And like he told the officer at the beginning of Return of the Jedi, who he says this Death Star is going to be operational as planned, said, don't we need it now? He says, I'll give you 2 weeks. And he's like, you know what? I don't think 2 weeks is going to be enough. And he looks over at the dead body of the general and he goes, yeah, we'll have this ready in 2 weeks. And that's how that part of it ends. And you have a moment when Darth Vader looks out the window and he is looking out and he sees Luke Skywalker in a vision and he's reaching out for his hand. And then he says, soon. So that is how the issue ends. And I read this story and I went, wow, this is kind of thick. And I looked over at the cover and thought, huh, I just paid $6 for this thing. And here's the credits. So we're all done. Then I turn the page and lo and behold, we continue with the story. We have Dr. Aphra, who just got whipped out of the airlock, and the two droids that are that she created, they're angry droids. It's sort of like bad R2 and 3PO. Fly by, they pick her up, they bring her onto the ship, and she's like, whoa, that was fun. I don't ever want to do that again, but I can't believe I survived that long out in space. So now you're starting to wonder, is she really all human or is she droid? And then she says, let's never do that again. And then the ship takes off. And that part was called Coda. So then we turn the page and then we have Darth Vader. And it talks about the fact that Darth Vader was, oh, this is the Coda actually. Darth Vader, when he lost his mother, went into a whole village of Tusken Raiders and killed them all. And it says, months ago, Darth Vader arrived for the first time on Tatooine while waiting for two bounty hunters. He passed the time by slaughtering a whole village of Tusken Raiders, or so we thought. So you go into this, and it's got Darth Vader. He's walking through, and he sees all these dead Tusken Raiders, except for one that is, like, looking down at the whole thing. He goes through. You see him kind of surviving in the desert by himself for a few days. And he's got the classic Tusken Raider look. But then you see this other nomadic tribe show up of Tusken Raiders, and they all sort of look like the ones that he wiped out. Like, they have different faces. They don't have the pronounced eyes, the big mouth. That's the moisture evaporator collector. And you see that, and it's no words in here. So you see around the fire, as these two Tusken Raiders are talking, a whole village of them come up. And they're coming up, and they've got all different looks. So you can see that Vader has really wiped out the population, which probably isn't a bad thing. And then the chief storyteller begins to tell him a story about how this man came from the stars and wiped us out. And then he left and came back and wiped us out again. And they're up by some junk. They're building stuff. And the story is scaring everybody. And then bottom line is, at the very end of it, you see that they have created a huge Darth Vader image out of metal. And they're all bowing and worshiping it.
Huh.
So Sand People love their Darth Vader. Then you get a cover gallery of three pages of all the books that are in here. So this is the last issue of Star Wars. And I am going to see if I can rip off the thing without ruining it. Ta-da!
But can you read it?
But can I read it? Because I don't have my glasses. The code, marvel.com redeem, slash redeem. Oh boy. Mm-hmm. Let's look at this one
here
again.
Here we go.
Here
That's
we go.
That's my favorite part of the show.
There we go. Let's see. S-C-O. Oh, I can't even do this one. So after you do yours, I'm going to run up and I'm going to look in the light.
Would you like me to read it?
Why don't you read it?
I'll be happy to read it for you.
We should.
I'm keeping all of this in the show. The coffee table that Matthew records on just collapsed. This is our 750th episode, by the way. Okay, people. This is your marvel.com/redeem code. The first person to enter this code is going to get a free copy of the $6 Darth Vader number 25. It is S-C-O-O-X-K-U-5-C-U-Q-A. That is the code you want to enter at marvel.com/redeem. And if you do so, you will get yourself a free copy of Darth Vader number 25, crashing table not included.
I was going to say, there's blood in that book.
I was going to mark that by the time, because I'm sure that there will be quite a spike in the... in the audio wave at that particular point in time. But it's all part of the adventure that is recording this show every single week. First time in 750 episodes.
That is.
That your table collapsed while we were recording the show. So that's a first.
And I'll explain that what the way this is, it's like a pull-up table.
It is.
And the pull-up side is where I am. So, of course, if I lean on it,
uh-huh,
it's going to go forward. If it was set up the other way, would not have happened.
Really, really well executed. So we are going to now go over to Action Lab. It is, as we record this, pre-Halloween at this point. Mm-hmm. So I am in full-on horror movie, horror comic, horror video game mode. I just consume. I normally consume quite a bit of horror to begin with, but when it comes to the month of October, it is It is like my Christmas.
It's Christmas. It's a holiday. Yes,
I am very excited about that. So we're going to go over to Action Labs Danger Zone and talk about Charles Band's Puppet Master. This is a one-shot. It's their Halloween special. It is called Halloween 1989, The Creature. Written by Sean Gaboran, art by Daniel Logan, colors by Dan Oliveira, and the editor on this book, does it even say? Editor-in-chief Sean Gaboran. Now, Jamal Igel, I think, is moving on as the VP of marketing from Action Lab, but he is still on this particular issue here. And Puppet Master, for those of you that don't know, I think we talked about Oblivion in the last episode. That was a Full Moon Pictures feature. Puppet Master, also Full Moon Pictures. And I'm sure you must have, over time, seen at least one Puppet Master film. So, you know, you have your... sort of white puppet with the dagger in his hand. His name is Blade.
That's the one everybody knows.
That's
him,
and
the drill head guy.
Yes, that is Tunneler. He is in that as well. But we start off, the hotel that many of the Puppet Master stories are set in is called the Bodega Bay Inn, I believe. And as we start this book, it is 1989, it is Halloween, and you are seeing at nighttime the Bodega Bay Inn, which is sort of on the shoreline, on this sort of raised cliff area overlooking the water. And you're seeing that there is a glow coming from a small cave down by the water. And as the panels zoom in, you see that there's sort of like a creature who is emerging from this cave. And he's sort of got red skin and claws and huge teeth. He almost looks like a goblin. But he's completely, his skin is all red, and he's got sort of tattered clothing and stuff like that. And he's growling, and he crawls out of the cave, and he makes his way up the cliffside stairs to the Bodega Bay Inn. And you could see that he is going to be making his way into the hotel. Now, I believe when this takes place, it is after the first movie. And so the wife of one of the characters from the first movie is left at the end of the first Puppet Master story. And you see that she has mastered the reanimating of puppets that Toulon, who was the first character, the puppeteer, who was in the movie. I won't go too far down the rabbit hole of the Puppet Master lore. But there is a woman who lives in this abandoned hotel now with the puppets. And as you see this creature crawl into the hotel, you see a lot of the furniture is, you know, covered in sheets and things because the hotel's not really operational at this point. And he starts stumbling around the hotel. And as soon as he does, he runs into what the heck is his name? Pinhead, which is the gigantic beefcake puppet that has a tiny, tiny head. And so he comes running out and starts attacking the monster. And the monster sort of throws him off. And much of this issue is the monster making its way through this hotel looking for, presumably, Megan, who is the woman that now lives in the hotel, and the puppets trying to stop him. So the puppets see him as a threat. This monster comes in, he faces off against Blade, and Blade manages to wound him, but the creature keeps going. You see upstairs where Megan is sleeping that Jester, who is the clown spinning face puppet, and Madame Leech, who is the one that vomits leeches out onto people, are up there sort of in the bedroom protecting Megan, and they run out because they know that there's a threat in the hotel. So now all the puppets have gathered together, and they see that this monster has now made its way to the kitchen, and it's eating the food that's left out and just absolutely, you know, gulping everything down. And the puppets are making a plan of how they're going to defeat this monster before it gets upstairs to find Megan. And so you get many scenes where you're seeing each of the abilities that these puppets have, where Tunneler, you know, drills a hole right in the creature's leg, and the creature, you know, roars and then keeps going but throws Tunneler out of the way because they're just little puppets. Then you have Madame Leech, who attacks with a knife. She gets tossed aside. Blade manages to slow him down, and Jester comes out with an axe, and they're all slowly but surely, you know, nicking away and taking chunks out of this thing, to the point where it is now in the hallway where Megan is, and it is pretty badly wounded, and it's sort of dragging itself along. And as it is, the puppets are attacking it left and right. And then one of them goes to grab the creature's face and starts to pull at it, and it turns out it's a mask. And as they pull the mask off, you see that it is a dude who was wearing this creature mask, and he's bleeding out. And then as he's bleeding out and he's kind of choking and everything, he's flashing back to the fact that there was a Halloween party that was happening in this cave by the shore. And a bunch of drunken teenagers were basically saying, hey, you know, one of the kids was saying, oh, I know the woman that lives in the hotel now. You know, she was married to this creepy guy before, and my parents used to work there or something like that. And the people that are drinking at the at this party are saying, well, you should go scare her. We dare you to go into the hotel and scare the crap out of her with your costume on and everything. And they kind of goad him into doing it. And you see that this was all supposed to be a prank. He was going to sneak into the hotel. He was going to sneak up to her room and he was going to scare the crap out of her. Little did he know that he was going to run into an army of evil puppets. And so as he is sort of dying, you hear a commotion downstairs and his friends have come up to the hotel to see why he hasn't returned yet. And as they open the door, they see him lying there and they also see the puppets. And the next thing you know, it's the next day. And Megan comes downstairs and she's, oh, good morning to the puppets. She's talking because she treats them like her own children. And she's saying, you know, my parents would have had a much better setup for trick-or-treaters. They used to welcome the kids every year. You know, maybe next year we'll bring that back because it's kind of quiet around here on Halloween now, and that's kind of a bummer. And as she's saying that, you flash over to the cave where the party was going on last night, and the dismembered corpses of all of the partygoers are strewn about the cave there, and that's the way that the issue ends. So that was like a mini Puppet Master movie in one particular thing. And it was pretty interesting there. So I feel like the Action Lab Danger Zone series that are off of the Full Moon properties do a really good job of capturing the feel of those movies. They are a little bit cheesy and a lot gory and kind of fun to read. And that's the way all of the Puppet Master comics that I've read from Action Lab have come out. So if you're into that, or if you haven't checked the series out and you just kind of want to see what the flavor of it is, then this is a good one shot to pick up.
So a book that I've been excited about for a little while, and I finally got the chance to read it, and that is Revolution from IDW. This is the crossover event in the first issue featuring Action Man, G.I. Joe, Transformers, and ROM. Now, IDW has the ROM license. They just recently put out the third issue, I believe.
Can I just stop you for 1 second?
Absolutely.
Because, and I apologize because as people are listening to this, this deal is over. However, if you follow the Humble Bundle at all, and I know I've mentioned that a couple times on this show, there was a Transformers Humble Bundle that came out over the past few weeks. And for $15, you basically got almost every Transformers comic that's been written over the past, like, I'm going to say like 7 or 8 years.
Wow.
Like all the Robots in Disguise volumes, all the stuff leading up to it, as well as the first two issues of Revolution and like four of the tie-in issues of it for $15.
Oh my gosh.
So I bought that Humble Bundle. And the thing with Humble Bundle is that a lot of the money goes to charity.
Yep.
And so it was for a good cause. And I probably have almost $500 worth of Transformers comics now that I got from that. So I'm going to be catching up on all of that leading to this because I'm excited about this new continuity that they're creating with all of these properties meshed together.
Yeah. And the only two groups we don't have in here right now who will be showing up are the Micronauts and Mask. So interesting that I was at work.
Do you mean Mobile Armored Strike Command?
That would be them. Or the guys that had a chocolate milk tie-in. That's all I remember.
I think you're right.
That's all I remember, the ads for Mask and Nestle Quick. That's all I remember because I never read Mask. I don't, never watched it. Don't even know what they are.
It was a cool cartoon.
So, first of all, it's written by John Barber and Colin Bunn. Frico Osseo is the artist. Sebastian Cheng, the colorist. Tom Long, the letterer. Dave Hedgecock, the editor. Editor-in-chief, our buddy Chris Royale. And Ted Adams is the publisher. So, I was at work last week talking to a friend of mine, John, and we were talking about this whole thing. He read this, and he is really big into Transformers, loves Mask. So he said, I'm really kind of having a tough time following this. Can I explain this to you? And I said, and he goes, sure. So John really helped me kind of get a grasp of what is going on. He said, what do you think is going on right now? And I said, it looks like the Transformers have come to Earth and said to the Earth, we're going to protect you. We are going to do everything we can to help you and protect you as a planet. And we don't want anything in return, but people aren't hearing that. They're hearing, you just want to boss us around and kind of enslave us. So people aren't very Transformer happy right now. They're very anti-Transformer. They're trying to find ways to beat this. So going into that, I know what the story is happening now. And we have way up in the mountains, we have Action Man who is following a trail with his partner, and he gets into a cave. And in the cave, he finds a British G.I. Joe named Big Ben. Do you remember Big Ben?
No.
So he might have been for the comics. But
what was the name of the G.I. Joe comic? Was it Action Force?
I don't remember.
The one in the UK one? Because I'm pretty sure that's the version that Quick Kick appeared in quite a bit.
It might have been. It might be. So Action Man, who as in the toy world was the British version of G.I. Joe.
Uh-huh.
But now you've got a Joe who's a Brit, Big Ben, who is lost in a pile of rocks, and these rocks are glowing, and he is sinking and being eaten alive by these things. And Action Man's coming in there going, what are you doing here? And he says, well, I'm here. I'm trying to blow these things up and blow this up. And what it is this is the stuff that Transformers
eat. Energon?
That's the stuff. Mm-hmm. So they're figuring that if they blow this up and get rid of it, that is a huge power source, and they won't be able to take over the world they think they are, and then humans will get their planet back.
They're sticking it to the man. And in this case, the man being giant transforming robots.
And let us screw up our world. Let's not have some big robots doing it.
Right, we can do this ourselves.
So the cave blows up. Everything is in shambles. And Big Ben dies. Action Man and his partner get out. And then you go to the White House, and you see that Scarlet is in a sort of a political office in the White House. So she's there talking to the president, and they're like, we don't know what just happened up in the mountain. Something blew up, and the Transformers aren't too happy about it. So we're assuming it was important to them. Now they're going to come after us. And they're not even going to come after them, but they're already jumping the gun. They're like, we need to get everybody mobilized. We need to get everybody ready. And they're like, look, robot invaders from space. All of a sudden, Scarlet shows up, and she's like, you know, we were born to fight. That's what G.I. Joe does. Let us get ready.
It's true.
So meanwhile,
G.I. Joe does do that.
That it is. So meanwhile, we go to Autobot City, Monument Valley, and they're sitting there, all the Transformers, and they're going, realizing that this has just happened and this is not good. So they're thinking, you know, so a couple of the Transformers are saying, you know, well, I understand why the humans are angry. I understand what they're doing. I understand this. But it seems like Optimus Prime is a little more not understanding. He's like, look, I don't know what we can do. We've basically given them the olive branch. We are going to protect them. And
he's like, I have been talking until I'm silver in the face about how much we want to help you people.
I like that. So you've got a couple of them in there that are saying, you know what? They blew up our crap. Let's just go take care of them and blow them up. So they think, you know what? Let's go find out what is going on. We'll go in peace. And we'll go figure this out. Well, you know that's not going to be right because you turn the page and you've got Transformers fighting G.I. Joes for the next 7 or 8 pages. And the team for the Joes is – so you have Big Ben who's no longer with us anymore. You've got the president. You got Joe Colton, Scarlet, Rock and Roll, Mainframe, who might be very important at this particular moment.
Uh-huh.
Beachhead, Mayday, Roadblock, and Grunt.
What about Quick Kick and Lowlight?
And no Nutshot either. So those three Joes are missing.
That's sad.
Yeah, and then Transformers, you got Optimus Prime, Soundwave, Windblade, Cup, Arcee, Jazz, and Victoron. Is that? I don't know who that guy is.
I mean, obviously, you need to catch up on your Transformers.
Yeah.
You should have taken advantage of that humble bundle.
Yes, I should
have. But you did not.
So all of a sudden, the Transformers show up to try to speak their mind about things.
Uh-huh.
A battle with the Joe show, and it is great. You have 7 or 8 pages of some serious battles going on. All of a sudden they're using weapons that the Transformers are thinking, where did they get these? Because this kind of works and it hurts us and this isn't good. Mainframe is trying to get in there and disrupt every possible system that he can to see what's going on. And then all of a sudden, as the battle is starting to turn towards the Joes and away from the Transformers, Rom shows up. And Rom comes flying through. Now, Rom, if you're not reading the regular book, Rom is a robot that came to space and his whole mission is to fight a group called the Dire Wraiths. Now, these people have sort of basically taken over humans, and their entity lives inside of a human person, and that person is no longer existing anymore. So when he sees them, he only sees the shadow of the bad and will wipe them out and kill them.
Uh-huh.
However, if he goes to my house and kills my wife because she is infected by the Dire Wraiths, I don't know that.
Right.
And Rom is an infected.
You just think that Rom's a bad dude.
Wow, he just killed my wife. So what happens is he goes in and he shoots and kills Joe Colton. Joe Colton is now dead.
Ooh.
So, and he's like a head guy of the Joes,
right?
He is
the G.I. Joe, is he not?
Joe's dead.
He is the original G.I. Joe.
Joe is dead. And Scarlet is looking down going, I don't know what you just did. And apparently you're our size, but you're a robot too. So you're now on our crap list. So we are going to come after you. They all start shooting at Rom, and Rom doesn't even explain anything. He just takes off, and now the Transformers are thinking, yeah, that's great. Now they think this guy's with us. So this is going to cause more of a problem. So they take off. They go back to where they're going to go. And now you're trying to think maybe cooler heads are going to prevail in this whole thing. So as they take off, you see Scarlett in a page where she is just biting her lip, ripping mad, and explaining, this isn't going to happen, and all I know is G.I. Joe is going to win. So you have to be continued. And then you have a page or two of script. You also have where Free Comic Book Day gave away sort of a prelude to Revolution, and you get the entire issue here if you hadn't already read it. So I read this one as a refresher, and you get just the whole – basically it's the buildup of what has gone on and what is happening in the world according to this. And they're explaining where everybody has their goals, everybody has their thing, and you don't have any explanation of the Micronauts or Mask and how they're going to be in here, but they show up in the second issue. Huh. So a lot of fun, and it doesn't really take a lot to figure out what's going on. And if you're like me that you don't have a huge history in G.I. Joe or in Transformers, it's just dudes killing things and blowing stuff up. That's all you need to know.
I don't understand how you cannot have a huge love for the G.I. Joe cartoon.
You know why?
Explain that to me.
I can explain it pretty quick and make you go, oh, that makes sense. When the G.I. Joe cartoon hit, I was probably a junior in high school.
Okay.
And
that makes sense.
And it was a lot like all that stuff that came out at that time. You had He-Man came out, Transformers came out.
How many years older than me are you? So what was I?
So you were probably in like 7th or 8th grade. I think I'm 4 or 5 years older than you.
Okay, yeah.
And so it's not that I didn't like cartoons because I was still watching all my stuff.
Sure.
It's just I didn't want to watch
something. It was like Hong Kong Phooey and stuff like that. That's what you were still hooked on.
Yeah. I was looking at black and white Mickey Mouse cartoons.
Yeah, Captain Caveman.
So it just was that thing where it's just the an Jetsons. Age thing. Yeah. I didn't have time.
No, you had other stuff.
Exactly what it was.
I am very excited to dig into the Transformer stuff, and I will probably be talking about some of that stuff either in Out of the Long Box or in some special segments. So if you're a Transformers fan, look forward to that. If you are a Kurt Russell or a John Carpenter fan, look forward to this.
Mm.
Big Trouble in Little China, Escape from New York, a 6-issue limited series from Boom that I'm going to talk about right now, written by Mr. Greg Pak, art by Daniel Bayliss, colors by Triona Farrell, letters by Simon Boland, and it is edited by Daphna Pleven. And I mean, what's your guess as to how they're going to mash these two properties together?
And the interesting thing too is like I always, you know, when I talk about you to other people and they're like, so what is Brian like? And, you know, stuff like that. And I usually will honestly start out, his favorite actor is Kurt Russell. His favorite movie is Big Trouble in Little China. And he has a huge thing for Snake Plissken.
I will tell you that there is a plot point in this series that not only have I thought about many times, but now I consider to be canon after I read
Perfect.
This. So we start off in Lubbock, Texas in 1987, which is not long after the events of Big Trouble in Little China.
That takes place in Lubbock, Texas?
No.
Oh, because I was going to say my cousins, the only cousins I have live in
Lubbock. It takes place in San Francisco, Chinatown.
Oh, that's right.
We are now in Lubbock, Texas, though, because Jack Burton's a trucker.
Mm.
And he's on the Pork Chop Express, and he is listening to, what the heck is the name of the singer that he's listening to? He is listening to Blind Apple Mary, a 1952 cassette of hers. And he's, of course, you know, just narrating into the radio to anybody who will listen. He's singing along. He says, I don't even know how to explain how much I love that song, but the funny thing is, that's not me. Old Jack Burton might get into a lot of scrapes, like fighting sorcerers and monsters in a couple of 100 feet below San Francisco. And he goes, he's talking about what happened, and he's talking about how you can go to the Dragon of the Blackpool restaurant and ask my good buddy Wang Chi. And so he's kind of giving some nods to the events of Big Trouble in Little China. You know that already if you follow these characters.
Never saw the movie.
But as he's... That's not true, right?
No, I never have seen it.
Shut your mouth.
We've talked about this. I have never, ever seen it.
I don't think we have talked about this. And this is turning out to be a very concerning episode on a very special episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. Matthew comes clean. He's about a secret he's held for many years. We will remedy that very, very quickly.
Yes.
That is, that's probably the greatest movie of all time.
And I know that you love it.
It's probably the greatest movie of all time. We'll talk about that later, though. So he's talking, into his radio, and all of a sudden you hear this disembodied voice saying, yeah, and you're a meddler and a murderer. That's what you really are. And you look over and he's got the ghost of Lo Pan, who is the major villain, the sorcerer that Jack Burton defeats in Big Trouble in Little China. And Lo Pan is now like haunting him. Although Jack doesn't even know that. He's not even paying attention to that. He's just John on the radio, and Lo Pan is talking about, one of these days I'm going to pay you back. One of these days you're going to pay for what you did to me. He's talking about, you can't imagine the shame. You know, now I'm condemned to the hell of those who are killed by idiots. Because in the movie, there's a lot of jokes about the hell of this, the hell of that. And at one point, they talk about how there's a lot of hells. And so he's talking about, I'm in the hell of people who are killed by idiots. And he's swearing revenge on Jack Burton. But as Jack Burton is driving, all of a sudden he drives through like a wormhole. And when he comes out the other side, it's like a scene out of Mad Max. He is now in Marauder territory, Okla, Texas, in 2001. And he's in the world of Escape from New York. And so he is being fired upon by, again, all of these dudes in vehicles, these marauders in vehicles that look like they're right out of Mad Max. And so he just shows up in the middle of this. All of a sudden, this guy in an old postal truck pulls up next to him and is like, Snake, I'm coming up on your side. Follow me. And it's a guy that looks like his buddy Wang, but he's not. He's this reality's version of that same dude. And so he's driving. He's saying, oh, you got to follow me. You know, these guys are after us. And they're driving along a bridge that is actually falling apart. And so he ends up pulling almost a 180 and almost jackknifing his tractor trailer and knocking these marauders off the side of this freeway and stopping them. And then, you know, the guy who he thinks is his buddy gets out and he's like, oh, that's what I'm talking about. That's how Snake Plissken does it. And Jack gets out and he's like, yeah, that's how Snake Plissken does it, right? That's me. I'm Snake Plissken. And so all of these people, these more marauders show up, and all of a sudden Wang's like, yeah, you guys might want to get lost because this is Snake Plissken here and you don't want to mess with him. And so they turn tail and they get out of there. And next thing you know, we're in Okla, Texas, a little farther away at some diner. And you see in a shadowy corner, Snake Plissken having a drink. And over the radio, you hear a couple of the marauders, because this is a place where the gang hangs out, saying, oh, you know, everybody, all hands on deck. We got this guy, this number one guy that we're out to kill now, and his name is Snake Plissken. And then it turns around, and you see Snake Plissken sitting there. And all of a sudden, everybody in the bar looks over at Snake, and he says, ah, why don't you guys call me Snake? And he gets up, he kills everybody in the bar. And he ends up walking out of there. And so the premise of this issue becomes, Snake is now pissed off because someone is out there impersonating him and causing this whole band of marauders to try to hunt him down and causing him all this grief. So Jack follows this guy to Lubbock, Texas, where there is a bunker where he calls it the office. And his buddy kind of brings him back in there, and he says, he introduces himself to him. He says, my name is Bobby Lou. And Jack's looking at him like, you're not Bobby Lou. You're my buddy Wang Chi. And so they're talking, and Jack's trying to get an idea of what the heck is going on here. And Bobby says, you know, all this stuff happened before the war, he says, but I took an oath to defend the United States of America, and so that's why I summoned you here. And Jack says, what are you talking about? And he leads him into this vault in this bunker that they're in, and you see that there's a bunch of magical artifacts. And so what he did was he used one of these magic scrolls to summon Snake Plissken here. Instead, he summoned Jack Burton. And Jack's trying to explain to him, he says, I'm not the guy you're looking for. And all of a sudden somebody says, nah, you're him, all right. And he turns around, and Snake Plissken is now got his gun trained on Jack Burton. And of course, Bobby is like, what? You guys look just like each other. And so you get the inevitable, you know, fist fight where the two of them are knocking each other around and trying to figure out who's who. And Snake is basically saying, look, I'm going to kill you, and then I'm going to go deliver your body to the marauders, and then they're not going to bother me anymore. And you have Jack saying, look, that's not going to happen, buddy. And you have Bobby, who's basically trying to explain to them, I think I know what happened here. I think that you, both of you, are Snake Plissken. You're just the Snake Plissken of different realities. And that was the part where I was like, that's the only thing I've ever wanted to hear. Basically, Kurt Russell in every John Carpenter movie is the same character.
Yeah.
And so these are all connected realities. Perfect. He's like the eternal champion of the John Carpenter universe.
And it works.
It works perfectly. Because then there's other characters in the John Carpenter universe that also are the same characters through different realities. It's perfect. So anyways, Bobby convinces them that there is a group of people who are being attacked by the Marauders, and he needs them to go save these people and get them to the free city of Toronto. They have to escort them to Toronto. And they're like, who is the person? And he's like, oh, they're in the cultural center. There's these cultural bunkers where when the war was happening, they tried to take all of the, you know, most creative people and the most influential people and all the best artifacts and everything else. They tried to preserve the culture of this country. And so that's what these cultural bunkers are. And there's someone who's holed up in one of these cultural bunkers. And if we can save her, you know, we'll get her to Toronto. And that's why I need you guys. And her name is Blind Apple Mary. So the singer that Jack was listening to on an old cassette as he was driving along in the beginning of the issue is someone who in this reality is one of the cultural treasures of America. And now the two of them have to go and rescue her. And so the way that the first issue ends is they're agreeing to go and help. And they say, I'm in at the same time. And Snake says, I said, don't copy me. Shut up. You shut up. Why don't you shut up? And then you see that there's a group of Marauders outside the place that they're in who are about to lay siege to this place. And that's the way the first issue ends. So what I love about everything that Greg Pak writes is that he has that tinge of humor in it. And for this book, it's perfect. I fell off of the, I think it was Big Trouble in Little China book because it was written by Eric Powell, who does The Goon. And it was a little too out there for me. Like it didn't, it was just a little too out there for me. The Escape from New York book has been pretty consistently good. Mixing them both together is like a Reese's peanut butter cup of Jack Burton awesomeness. And so if you like either of those properties, I cannot recommend this series highly enough. Greg Pak is writing it. That's really all you need to know. The artwork is great as well. It's a 6-issue limited series, so it's not a huge commitment. And it's a great story to read, even if you haven't been reading either The Big Trouble in Little China or the Escape from New York series, because it's a complete standalone story.
It's a lot like when Ash and Xena teamed up and Joxer showed up.
Exactly.
And it's Bruce Campbell being both.
Exactly.
So.
It's like the Raimi-verse.
Yes.
This is the Carpenter-verse.
Very cool stuff. So a book that I'm going to talk about was something that came out this week. I got the trailer or the preview for it at New York Comic Con, and that is Kiss, written by Amy Chu. And art by Newber Ball. And the colors are by Shimbury's Ball.
I'm sure all of those were well-executed names, Matthew.
Lettering by Troy Pateri. That was an easy one.
Okay, it seems like you got that one.
So this is from Dynamite. Now, this is the latest attempt in the history of Kiss Comics. We've had Marvel. We've had Image. Image had the Psycho Circus line, which went a lot of issues and was really good. That was where I kind of discovered Greg Capullo's art.
Sure.
Was on that. Really, really enjoyed that book. Then we had, who was the other one that Platinum Comics did one? Then IDW did it, and now it's over to Dynamite. Now, this one is an interesting take because there is so much setup to this that you don't even see Kiss except in little images here and there.
Huh.
But there are enough mentions of Kiss things that make you, you know, get excited. So the premise is 460 years after the Great War, the last remnants of humanity live comfortably underground in a metropolis of Blackwell. Blackwell is Mr. Blackwell's island, and Mr. Blackwell was from the Kiss album, The Elder. But four teens start questioning everything about them and search for the truth about their past, and what they're about to discover are secrets that will rock their world. When I read this, I was reading this not thinking anything other than I just want to be entertained. I'm not expecting Kiss to come out and be the superheroes in this one because I'd like to see something different. So it starts out with the lyrics to A World Without Heroes as you see this world. And you turn the page and you see that, you know, 2020, kids are playing in the park. 2030, there is nobody because they're all dead. And then you see how later on it just got worse and worse. And the world on top of the world ended up being unlivable. So everybody went underground and that's where they live. And then you turn the page and you see that's basically a history lesson that is being taught right now. And the teacher is saying, you know, if anybody has any questions, can you, you know, please raise your hand. And somebody raises their hand and you've got twin boy and a girl. And they're like, yeah, I don't understand. Why can't we go to the top if it's been so long ago since it happened? And the guy's like, well, you know, they tell us that it's not safe to go up there, so we don't go. And he's like, well, what about if we just go? Because why don't we want to know what's going on up there? And then some woman raised her hand and says, the protectors are keeping us safe and keeping us down here. So that is why. And then everybody gets up and says, long may they live, the protectors. And you see that this is like a world indoctrination. And the two kids are walking away. They run into some friends of theirs. And as they're walking through, it's really interesting because the kid's backpack is white with a star. So you got the Paul Stanley icon right there. There's art that's all over the city, and you see one like on these vehicles, and it'll be like the face paint. You'll see like the Gene Simmons on like this robot that walks by, or the Catman makeup. You even see Eric Carr's fox mask.
Oh,
and like a picture. So you got all these little subtle things, and these kids are like, you know what? We need to figure out what's out there. Let's just go do this. Let's go out and find out what's going on. So they get a map, and they find this map. They find the things in the map and say, all right, well, we'll go here. We'll go a little bit underground. We'll go through these tunnels. And as they start going through and climbing up, you start feeling like you're reading a version of Logan's Run, where you were living in this dystopian society that was not what it should have been for everybody. And as people are trying to escape and find sanctuary, they go through these tunnels and mazes. And that was what this was a little bit like. So that was my appeal, getting sucked right into this. So the kids are going through and they're seeing things like these, the face, the kiss masks, images all over the place. They don't know what they are. They see graffiti on the wall that says kiss, and they're like, what does that mean? They're like, I don't know, just keep going. So as they're going in, they go through some vents and they come into, and the book too, by the way, very gray, very dark, very moody looking, until you turn the page and you come into this beautiful green oasis where it's like, it's a Garden of Eden, and they go in there. And they're looking around. They're like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. It's an apple. And they're seeing all the things. And this girl goes over and hugs a tree. And she's like, I'm in heaven. A girl goes up and grabs an apple. And then all of a sudden, these robots come in and start chasing the kids. One of them falls, hurts his ankle. They pick him up. They start running. And now they're running through more like underground tube systems. And there you're seeing pictures of all the guys in Kiss. And it's like, it's from the solo albums. You're seeing the art. And as they're running, they're like, what are those? We don't know. We don't know what those are. So they keep running. They get into somewhere. And as they go through, they come into this place now where it looks like a monastery. And as they go in, they're sitting there trying to catch their breath. And there's a lot of the subtle little things, like the cover for Music from the Elder. I'll show you, Brian, with the hand hitting the doorknob.
Uh-huh.
That's in there as they reach up to knock on the door of this monastery. And when they get in there, they just keep finding more things. They go into a sanctuary or a worship center where it has all the Kiss logos in the stained glass. They're talking about what they want to do. And one of the kids is like, look, we got to get home. And this girl's like, I'm not going anywhere. I want to stay here. I feel at peace. I don't know why. I don't know what's going on. They see that everything's dusty. They go on and there's a computer that's all covered in dust. They blow the dust away and they're looking at all the buttons and they hit a button. And right after she hits it, the kid's like, no, don't do that. We don't know what it is. And the button starts to turn green, and then the room goes blank, and then it flashes with the four members of Kiss's face on a projection as these kids are down there looking up. And that is how this issue ends. So a lot of fun. I really, really like this. I thought that there were enough of the subtleties that made me realize it's not just a kids running away comic. It is a Kiss comic. And there's a cool couple pages at the end where you've got Gene, who's talking about as a fanboy, he's always loved comics, especially Marvel. And then you got Paul saying, you know, is this book good? It's dynamite, because it's in dynamite sure. print. And then you have some other things, like you have a cover gallery. There are 20 something covers that this book came out with. I got the one that has all of them because I thought that would just
be a solid choice.
Yep. And you have a Francesco Francavilla cover.
Oh, well, that would be the one that I chose, obviously. Yeah,
so there's some fun ones, but this is a book that I'm really looking forward to seeing where it goes. I'll say it right now, if it wasn't a Kiss comic, I probably wouldn't be getting it.
Sure.
But it is a Kiss comic, and I'm liking where they're going with it. I really am curious to see how they're going to use Kiss in this book.
I like that it's not just about the members of the band, that they're building a mythology around yep. their characters and stuff like that, because really, what else are you going to do? I mean, if you're not going to play off of the characters,
yep.
what are you doing with
Kiss? And that's already been done. That's already been done to death, so you've got to try to find these different things. So, yeah,
I thought they were going to be the monks at the monastery.
They might be. You never know.
So
never know.
That was my prediction, but there you go. That's your new books for this week. Now, we have had Dynamite. We've had IDW. We have had Marvel. We have had Action Lab, and we have had Boom.
Mm.
That's pretty good.
That's very varied. That's hitting
to all fields.
Yep.
We're going to now go to Image for our Out of the Long Box this week. And we're going to talk about Morning Glories. And this was a series which is written by Nick Spencer, art by Joe Eisma, covers by Rodin SKO. And the editor on this one is Jim. He did the reprint edits, Jim Valentino. This was a book that you were reading when it first came out, and you interviewed Nick Spencer, I believe.
I interviewed him a week before the book came out. Yep. A week after it came out.
And I believe you also talked to Joe Eisma at one point
as well
about this book. So maybe I'll have to go back and re-listen to those interviews because I was not reading it at the time. However, I am now a member of the Comixology Unlimited, which I believe I want to say is like $6 a month, and you can add it onto your Comixology account and you get unlimited reads or downloads or whatever out of a select number of titles in the Comixology library. And they had the first two volumes of Morning Glories in there, so I decided to give it a read. And it's a pretty interesting book. As we open up the first issue, you have someone who's in a hospital and they're staring down at a note that says, "For a better future." And you see that they're then being led away to see somebody who was obviously brought in because they were injured or something like that. And then we just cut away from that. That's one page. Now you see that same saying that's on a wall, on a poster in a classroom of what looks like a boarding school. It says, "For a better future." And you have a teacher who is lecturing. You know, I know all of you have been greatly looking forward to this week's annual science fair. And I'd like to offer the opportunity for any of the two of you. And she looks over and one of the girls is passing a note. And she says, "Is that a note, Akiko?" "Oh, yeah, I'm really sorry about that." And of course, she grabs the note and she says, "Well, since you're obviously so far along that you have time to pass notes, why don't you tell us about the project that you've been working on that everybody's supposed to be focused on in class?" And she has to stand up now and she has to present in front of the class. And she's saying, "You know, my experiment is in the field of chemistry and it deals with nitrogen triiodide and outside stimuli to it in a solid state." And she's basically talking about how it's this explosive that you can make and all of this kind of stuff. And the teacher's saying, "Well, it sounds like maybe you've kind of been doing a good job." And she kind of lets her off the hook. And the girl's still talking. And the teacher is going to write something on the board. And the girl is saying, "You know, the slightest pressure can ignite it, which, you know, poses problems because if it's on a dark surface, you don't even see it." And as soon as she says that, the teacher makes a mark on the board and the board explodes and sends her flying across the room. And Akiko tries to go out the window. Security guards come in and they end up subduing her. But the teacher says, "You know what?" And the teacher's name is Miss Darimount. And they says, "You know, we got her. What do you want us to do with her?" And she said, "That girl's just a diversion. Find out who's actually trying to escape." You cut to the hallway and you see two characters, Vanessa and who is the other one? I forget who the guy's name is, but they sort of are saying goodbyes to each other and they're both trying to escape from the school and they're going to head out of there. And so Akiko was running a diversion for them. But of course, they get subdued before they actually make it there. And the guy ends up escaping from the main building, but he finds himself almost in a hangar where there is this creature down there who is kind of like a wraith and comes over to him and almost like a vision can put his hand in the guy's head. And this guy who's trying to escape gets a hand through his head and his brain starts basically melting and he ends up getting killed. And you see that whatever's going on at this school is clearly something much different than what goes on at most boarding schools. They're doing some experiments here. It seems like the students are prisoners here. And Miss Darimount is talking to one of the other faculty, I guess. And he's saying, "You know, don't worry because tomorrow's enrollment day and we have a whole bunch of new recruits coming in and I have high hopes for some of them." So that's your sort of prologue. Then you turn the page and you see the different students that are coming to this school. There's a young woman named Casey who's coming to the school. She's from Chicago and her parents are really excited for her because she's going away to this boarding school and she got accepted earlier. You see that there is another kid whose name is Ike, who is a rich kid who's kind of like a psycho. And he is there with his mother and they're talking at a very long dinner table about how he might have actually killed his father or something like that. And so this kid is just straight up evil. Then you go to San Diego and you have this young woman whose name is, I can't remember what her name is, Zoe. And she is sort of like a popular girl who has like five different boyfriends, and she's telling all of them, don't forget about me, you know, you're the only one for me. And she's saying goodbye to all of them as she speeds off to go to the school. Then you're in Toronto, and you see Hunter, who is getting ready to go to school as well, and you see his home situation is not that well. So you see all of these kids, and then you go and you find the last girl, I believe, whose name is Jade, and she is getting sent to the school as well. And you also see, who else is the other kid there? It is Fukuyama Jun, and I think June is for short. And so he's getting brought to the school too. So there's a whole bunch of kids that get brought to this place, and the first person that greets them at this new school is Miss Darimount. And as they get out of the car, they've been drugged on their way there and they don't even know it.
Yep.
And they arrive at this school and they're not really sure even where it is. And they get out and they are at Morning Glory Academy. And so they get to this place and Miss Darimount is the one that is talking to them. She's saying, you know, this place was a monastery before for two centuries and now it's this prestigious school. And so she's telling them about what a wonderful history the school has and only the top students get in and all this kind of stuff. And as they're taking a tour, you see a bunch of kids going to and from classes. You see this wraith creature that was in the beginning of this story kind of walk through the hall and follow Miss Darimount and sort of watching her. And you see all the kids are just being shown different classes and things like that. They get brought into one class and it's like an orientation. And as they're getting oriented to this class and they're being told about how great the school is, there's a flashing picture of like someone cutting the throat of a goat or something like that. And one of the kids is like, did they just flash a picture of someone cutting the head of the goat? So it's like subliminal messaging. Yep. And they keep seeing that title, for a better future, for a better future. And so most of the kids are not seeing that there's something weird going on yet. But you have this one girl, I believe it's Jade, who ends up calling her parents. And when she calls her parents, her father answers the phone. And she's saying, oh, Dad, you know, listen, it's me. I have a big problem. I left my notebook at home that I like to write in. Can you bring it to the school? And the guy's like, I think you have the wrong number. And she's like, what are you talking about, Dad? This is not funny. You know, it's your daughter. And he says, I don't know what kind of joke this is, but I don't have a daughter. And so she starts freaking out because the person on the other end of the phone, who is her father, is saying that he doesn't even remember her. So she ends up confiding in one of her roommates, the girl Cassie, whose parents were really proud of her for coming to the school, and saying, I don't know what's going on, but I just tried to call home and my dad doesn't even remember me and I don't know what's up. And so Cassie takes it upon herself to investigate this. And as she's investigating it, she's talking to one of the girls who has been at the school for a while, and she's kind of following her down the stairs and all this kind of stuff. And she's talking about how, yeah, my roommate just told me this weird thing. And she called her dad and she says her dad doesn't remember her. And this other girl's like, oh, sure. Yep. That makes sense. They're kind of walking. And Cassie's saying, that would never happen to me because my parents are totally, you know, I don't even know what they do without me. They're so, you know, loyal to me and all this kind of stuff. And this girl that she's talking to is saying, yeah, they really are. I mean, they really are, you know, and they would never forget about you. And as she's saying, you know, you should really be proud of them. We tried everything. And I don't want to sound like a big sap, but it's true. Sometimes love really does win in the end. And she opens up the door that they're walking down to, and you see Casey's parents that are both dead on the wall, having been tortured to death. Yep. And that's the way, I think this is more than one issue, but that's the way the first chapter of Morning Glories ends. And so pretty awesome beginning to that book.
Yeah.
And I haven't read any farther than that now, so I don't know what happens after that, but it's a great introduction that there's clearly something crazy going on at this school. And now these kids are basically trapped here because whether their parents have been brainwashed or their parents have been bought off or their parents have been threatened, they sort of have no outside life anymore. And now they're just here at the school. So I'm excited to see where this goes from here. And this is a story that I know I would have loved had I read it when it actually came out. But here I am sort of catching up with it now.
Yeah. And the thing with Nick Spencer, you're seeing it now with his writing, where basically you can see where he is writing a story and will throw, like the whole thing with Captain America, Hail Hydra. You put that in there. That's not even a ripple in the water for the story that he is going to be telling.
Right.
And that's the thing, like, you read this, and this was the first thing Nick ever wrote that I ever read. And I remember reading it going, oh my God, this is amazing. And then like 6, 7, 8, 20 something issues in, I'm like, we're not even where we were when we started this thing. Right. I am completely just engulfed in this whole world. But it is, as it starts to progress, you are really going to enjoy it. And I ended up getting away from it. I forgot how many issues in, maybe 25 or 30 issues. But it's just such a big scope of a story. And, you know, I always talk about Nick's writing. Joe's art is fantastic. Just, yeah. I wish he'd be doing something that I was reading.
Really, really good stuff. So I will definitely be catching up on the rest of that. And I think that's where this Comixology Unlimited thing has the potential to really do a good job of bringing people into books they might not have read before or might not have otherwise read, because here you go. They have the first 12 issues available for free.
Yep.
If you're part of Comixology Unlimited, and then the trades themselves are not that expensive. So you can finish the rest of the series, and then the creators are hopefully making a little bit of money off of that. And for me, I'm one of those people now who treats print almost like vinyl, where like if I read a great story digitally and I feel like I need to own that, I will then go and buy the trades.
Yeah.
And so I'm doing that more and more now, especially as I'm kind of cutting down on a little bit of the floppies that I'm buying and reading more stuff digitally. Digital for me is like the, oh, I want to keep this.
Yeah.
So print is like that. So I'll buy the print, the trade or something like that. So, but Morning Glory is good stuff. That is your Out of the Long Box for this week. That is going to do it for this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast, the fun-filled, adventurous 750th episode of Secret Identity. So for Mr. Matthew Herring, this is Brian Henry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.